The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
My name is Jason Freeman, and I'm pleased to join you here tonight to introduce our guest, David E. Sanger. The White House and National Security Correspondent for the New York Times, David E. Sanger has been a member of three Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist teams, including in 2017 for international reporting. His best-selling books include The Inheritance, The World Obama Confronts, and The Challenges to American Power, Confront and Conceal, Obama's Secret Wars and Surprising Use of American Power, and The Perfect Weapon, War Sabotage and Fear in the Cyber Age, which was adapted into an award-winning HBO documentary. He is also a regular contributor to CNN and teaches national security policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. He joins us tonight with his latest book, New Cold Wars, China's Rise, Russia's Invasion, and America's Struggle to Defend the West. Quite a weighty topic. In it, he offers an in-depth account of the United States' high-stakes struggles against two very dissimilar adversaries, Xi Jinping's China and Vladimir Putin's Russia. Of this book and its author, The New York Times writes, Sanger, a veteran reporter for The New York Times who is at home in the arcane world of strategic studies, has crafted a cogent, revealing account of how a generation of American officials have grappled with dangerous developments in the post-Cold War era. Tonight's author will be in conversation with retired Colonel Robert E. Hamilton, PhD. He's the head of research at the Foreign Policy Research Institute's Eurasia Program and an associate professor of Eurasian Studies at the U.S. Army War College. In a 30-year career in the U.S. Army, he spent primarily as a Eurasian Foreign Area Officer. He served overseas in Saudi Arabia, Iraq, Germany, Belarus, Qatar, Afghanistan, the Republic of Georgia, Pakistan, and Kuwait. He is the author of numerous articles and monographs on conflict and security issues, focusing principally on the former Soviet Union and the Balkans. He is a graduate of the German Armed Forces Staff College and the U.S. Army War College and holds a Bachelor of Science degree from the United States Military Academy, a Master's degree in Contemporary Russian Studies, and a PhD in Political Science, both from the University of Virginia. Philadelphia, please join me in welcoming tonight's guests.
So thank you all for showing up. Thanks to the Free Library for hosting. And David, thank you for making the trip up from Washington, D.C. to visit us in Philly here. I know you've had a whirlwind few days on Fareed Zakaria, John Stewart, Mary Louise Kelly from NPR. So thank you for being here tonight.
Thank you. Thanks. Great to be here.
So broadly, the book looks at essentially the last 30 years since the collapse of the Soviet Union and the end of the first Cold War. And what has gone wrong then from the time when Francis Fukuyama proclaimed the end of history and that liberal democracy was really the only system left standing to where we are now. So can you tell us just broadly what the book's about and where are we now?
Well, first, thanks very much for having me coming out for this conversation, and thanks to all of you for taking part of your evening to go hear about this. Philadelphia Free Library is really a terrific institution here, and it's great to be back here. This is a book about a giant shock in the American system, one that Americans probably haven't stopped to think that much about because we've had seemingly so many other shocks. But in the days after the collapse of the Soviet Union and the fall of the Berlin Wall, we worked on an assumption for 15, 20, really in some ways nearly 30 years, that Russia and China, each for their own reasons, would reintegrate with, or integrate for the first time, with Western society. That by bringing China into the World Trade Organization, they would begin to operate by American or at least Western-created rules. Nobody had the illusions that they were going to become a Jeffersonian democracy, but that it would change the society more than China would change, say, the WTO or any other institution. For Russia, it was a slightly different rationale, but a parallel one. And that one was that Russia was flat on its back after the collapse, that it was stunned by the loss of empire, that it had every reason to be cooperative with us as it moved toward uneasily a sort of corrupt democracy. The Yeltsin years were rough and, you know, full of coup attempts and all that, but that fundamentally they were on the right course if we encouraged them. And along the way, we took every single development that seemed to fit this narrative and I think invested a little bit too much in it. One of the great things that they worked out with Russia was that it would, thanks to money, billions of dollars that were approved by Congress and signed into law by Bush, Clinton, and Bush again, is that the Russians blended down their nuclear weapons into nuclear fuel that you could use in nuclear power plants. And for a good number of years, when you turned on the lights in the Midwest, in the U.S., you were being powered in part by basically the remnants of old nuclear warheads. And, you know, any day when you're reading nighttime stories to your kids with fuel that otherwise had been aimed at you, that's a pretty good day, right? For the Chinese, we saw a fairly similar process. They were engaged for many years under Jiang Zemin, Hu Jintao, and others in various moments when they would come together with the U.S. on projects that were in everybody's interest. They helped put together the six-party talks to go deal with a rapidly nuclearizing North Korea, which wasn't at all in China's interest. Obama reached a climate agreement with China, the first time that the world's two largest emitters had come to some agreements on how they would go restrict emissions. Russia and China together worked with the United States and the European Union on the Iran nuclear talks. And I spent about a year and a half of my life covering those talks back and forth in Vienna and elsewhere. And the Russians and the Chinese were sitting on the U.S. and European side of the table, and the Iranians were alone on the other side. Again, it wasn't perfect. There was, you know, sort of back and forth, pulling and pushing. But at the end of the day, it was the Russians who took the Iranian nuclear fuel and brought it into their own country and deprived the Iranians of the stuff they would need to make a bomb. They've since begun to recover quite nicely, thank you. Now speed forward to today. It's unimaginable that if you could get the Iran negotiations going again, and you probably couldn't, that you would be in a situation where the Russians and the Chinese were on our side. Russia is dependent on Iran for the drones, many of the drones it's using in Ukraine. It's building a Iranian-designed drone factory in Russia. The Chinese are building up their nuclear weapons stock after 50 years in which they used a minimum deterrent, something FPRI has written a lot about. I was in the Rose Garden the day that Xi Jinping came and told President Obama in public, in front of all of us, that they had no intention of militarizing the South China Sea and the islands they were reclaiming. A year and a half later, we were, with our visual investigations unit, running satellite photographs of fighter jets landing on newly constructed runways and going into military-style hangars. Similarly, we have seen a turn toward significant repression. This was not predicted. I was with Bill Clinton at Beijing University back toward the end of his second term when he gave a really brilliant speech, which I believed, and he believed, that the internet would set the Chinese people free. right? That it would undercut the Communist Party, that over time the combination of market economies and the revelation of how of the ideas floating around the internet from everybody else would basically rip the party apart. Instead, here we are, 30 years after Clinton said that, not even quite 30 years, and the internet has become, and other digital technologies, the exquisite tool of repression for the party. Facial recognition, monitoring of social media for dissident speech, using the internet and geolocators and where your phone is to go hunt down anybody with a concept critical of Xi Jinping and his thought. So the book is really about how we got this wrong, whether it had been worth the bet that we were right. And then after about 150 pages of that, it dives you deeply into the Biden White House and how they have dealt with these twin crises at, you know, which, each of which requires a very different approach.
So you talk in the book about over 30 years and five administrations hearing administration officials sort of repeat the narrative that through integrating Russia and China into the rules-based order, liberal order, whatever you want to call it, we can induce them to cooperate with it. And hearing the sort of conviction over time decline.
Yes, the quality of their confidence in their own argument, you know, which is one of the great things about being a White House reporter back and forth over time, which is, you know, you've sat there long enough to hear the same line in the back of Air Force One during a briefing, and you begin to sniff a decline in confidence levels. Mm. And this is certainly the biggest one, yeah.
Were there, so, you know, in Russia, there were certain sort of inflection points. You talk about Putin's 2007 Munich Security Conference speech, obviously the first invasion of Ukraine in 2014, and then the re-invasion in 2022. On the trajectory for China, so the question is, at what point do you think that we became aware that our attempt had failed, that the bet had not paid off with Russia and with China?
So with Russia and China, basically different timelines, mm-hmm. Okay? So let's start with Russia because it's the easier and clearer one. The first full chapter of the book, after scenes about the opening of the Ukraine war, is about a float down the Neva River. I apologize to anybody who watched the Jon Stewart episode earlier this week because I told the story there as well, but I'll do it briefly here. We're on the Neva River in outside of St. Petersburg. It's 2002, and Bush had just arrived in Russia to win over Putin to join his counterterrorism program. And of course, Putin was playing him brilliantly because he knew that as soon as he signed on, this was going to be his ticket to repressing the Chechens by simply declaring that they're terrorists, right? The Chinese did something similar with Uyghurs, Tibetans, and so forth. Everybody defines their terrorism problem a little bit differently. But it was an amazing night. It was late May or June, so it was light until 11 o'clock, you know, in St. Petersburg. It was one of the white nights. They were on this giant party boat. It was Bush and Laura Bush, Putin and his ex-wife. There's this big guy lurking in the background behind the table who was serving dinner. And, of course, I remembered this. It had stuck in my mind. I had no idea who he was at the time. And we finally went back and dug out photographs from the evening. And my wonderful research assistant of many years and co-author in this book, Mary Brooks, found this photo. And of course, it was Prigozhin, right, as Putin's chef, sitting back there, who then later in the book, goes on to invent the Internet Research Agency and try to fix the 2016 election for Putin, and then creates the Wagner Group, and then, of course, last year, marches on Moscow and gets within 150 miles before he stops, and, of course, a month later, steps on the wrong airplane. So all the characters that night are, the stage is set, you know, on the Neva River. And during the conversation on the boat, and I was on a trailing boat where the food was not as good and there was not as much vodka and certainly no caviar. As I went back and reconstructed for the book what was going on the boat, unfortunately Condi Rice had kept good notes and we flew out to go see her and sat down and went through it all. They talked about Russia joining the European Union. They talked about Russia eventually thinking about joining NATO. The alliance that was created to go contain the Soviet Union, right? We're about to go celebrate its 75th anniversary, just as it's ripping itself apart. That moment's going to come this summer. So that's 2002. As you suggested, 2007, Putin shows up at the Munich Security Conference's annual conference of European leaders, and he declares there are parts of Peter the Great's true Russia that have been ripped away from us that must be reunited. He clearly meant Ukraine, but not just Ukraine. And it was a really hardline speech. And Bob Gates was there, the former CIA director who then became defense secretary under Obama. Under Bush and stayed on under Obama. And he stands up and he says, I lived through one big Cold War. I'm really not eager to go to another. But this wasn't even a front page story in the New York Times back in the day when anybody cared what was on the print front page. We don't anymore, but in a pre-home page era. I think most Americans sort of blew it off. Well, he's venting. But at the end of the day, he needs his gas and oil revenue more than he needs, a war over Ukraine. Then 7 years later, the chapter that lays this out is called The Seven-Year Itch, with apologies to Marilyn Monroe. 7 years later, he takes Crimea. It takes the United States and the Allies a year to put sanctions together. Only when the airplane is shot down over Ukraine, right? And even then, the Germans, under Chancellor Merkel, sign the Nord Stream 2 pipeline agreement with Putin in 2015, the year after the Crimea invasion, and declare that he's a reliable supplier. And they're going to go ahead with a pipeline that will route around Ukraine, depriving Ukraine of any revenue from this, and go straight into Europe. So what's Putin supposed to think? That if he tries to get all of Ukraine, the Americans will make a lot of noise, maybe there'll be some sanctions resolutions, there'll be a lot of chest beating and condemnations, but at the end of the day, he'll get what he wants. And by the way, this game isn't over. So, let's watch what Congress does on Saturday. But just today, Bill Burns, who you'll see talking at great length in the book, the CIA director, on the record about his encounters with Putin, just today, as I was coming up here, said, if Congress doesn't pass this, expect Ukraine to lose by the end of the year. And Bill is not, I've known him for 25 years, he's not somebody who is, given to easy overstatement. So I would say that on the Russia side, we had every bit of warning. And we tried to ignore it. In fact, Obama did not even name Russia after its cyber attacks on the Pentagon, the State Department, and the White House, because he thought it would only inflame the situation if you call them out loud. And he wasn't the only one who did that. Bush before him didn't. Actually, it was the Trump administration that began calling out aggressors here. It wasn't Trump's own idea, but it was during the Trump administration. Give credit where credit is due. China was a different story. They were on an integrationist path until Xi Jinping came in. And one of the most interesting parts of the story is listening to Biden talk about his own relationships with Xi at when they were both vice presidents and they traveled around in the United States and in China together. Biden was given the portfolio to figure out Xi Jinping. And the problem is that he and the American intelligence community by and large got it wrong. And once Xi came into power, he gave this series of secret speeches you'll read about to build up the nuclear capability. He did the Hong Kong crackdown. And all of the early reports from a decade ago, oh, don't worry, he's going to work on building the domestic economy, turned out to be wrong.
You talk in a book about the fact that Russia and China represent sort of two different types of challenges. Russia is acute, militarized, and all its military and information. China is military, economic, and technological, right? And so in the U.S. national security community, there's this huge debate over how do we deal with both of these. You've got the Russia camp saying you've got to deal with Russia first. It's acute, militarized threat. And you've got the China folks saying we're taking our eye off the ball. We're mortgaging our ability to deal with the only potential peer competitor we have by fixating on Russia and Ukraine.
Or the Middle East.
Or the Middle East, right.
As you said,
we keep trying to pivot and we keep being dragged back into the Middle East or Europe. So can you talk, where do you fall on that question?
Well, the first place to fall is the definition of being a superpower is you've got to be able to do all of these at the same time. You know, it's not a choice between walking and chewing gum here. You've got to be able to handle Russia, handle China, and, you know, as a friend of mine in the intelligence community puts it so well, you know, the way to think about this is that Russia is the hurricane and China is climate change, right? With China, one of the reasons it's easy to sort of ignore the issue and put it aside is that the changes are pretty incremental. And they're not likely to be particularly vivid on CNN, right? Yeah. And with Russia, they're going to be incredibly vivid on CNN, but they may not have as much long-term effect in your life. And this is the complexity of running the United States and having it lead a grand alliance in a period like this. You've got to handle this. You've got to handle China and Russia, and you've got to be able to handle the Middle East. And I realize there's an attention span problem for leaders who are trying to do this in the course of the day. And if you think they've got an attention span problem, think about ordinary citizens who just turn on their TV, see chaos, and try to turn it off again and say, oh, it's so complicated, right? I'm not saying all citizens do, and certainly nobody who's ever walked through the doors of the Philadelphia Free Library has taken that position. But, you know, it's fairly tempting to go do. What the book tries to grapple with throughout, and a big subtext of it, is trying to understand the nature of the relationship between Russia and China, which has changed dramatically, right? That Bush meeting I mentioned on the Neva River was one of 24 meetings between Bush and Putin, more than 24. Anybody here have an idea how many times Biden as president has met Putin as president? Once. It was Geneva in 2021. It was a fascinating meeting, mostly about ransomware after the Colonial Pipeline cyber attack was driven. I would bet that they're never meeting again as presidents, right? Whether Biden is reelected or he's not reelected, I think the number of future meetings is the same. So the Russia-China relationship has been building in this time. Xi and Putin have met about 40 times as president. The critical one, the one that we all remember, are the days just before the opening of the Beijing Olympics. And Putin shows up ostensibly because he's interested in the skating or something. And it's middle of COVID. Both these guys have been like completely tucked away because everybody was scared to death that they would catch something. They're both 70 years old, right? Not that there's anything wrong with being 70 years old. I say as I approach my mid-60s here. Putin basically says to him, look, I've got this little business to take care of in Ukraine. It's going to be a couple of days. It's going to be a little bit messy. Don't worry about it. When it's all done, we'll be able to pick up and build our relationship again. And then they come out and they talk about a partnership without limits. It turns out it's a partnership, but with limits. But even inside the U.S. government, there were differences of opinion, and still are, about how deep it is. So one day I'm getting a briefing from a wonderful guy who was the number three in the Pentagon, named Colin Kahl, on the record thing he did with a number of reporters. And he basically said, look, this is real. As we have analyzed this thing, there are real talents and real products that the Chinese are now giving the Russians that are helping them proceed in the war, and things that the Russians are helping the Chinese with, including influence operations, which the Chinese are copying and so forth. So the next day, Biden has a press conference, and I'm in the chair for the Times. We usually swap off. And he made the mistake of calling on me for the last question. And so I asked him exactly the question that we had asked his number three in the Pentagon, which was, what do you think of the emerging Chinese-Russian relationship, and how should we think about it? And he took the other position. He said, there's not much here. These guys traditionally hate each other. You know, that history is long. He was accurate about that. But it was pretty clear to me that he and his own Pentagon were not in the same place on this. So I quoted the two right next to each other, which led the number three in the Pentagon, who I've known for many years, to call and offer his deep appreciation to me for putting him in open disagreement with his boss. But that's the fun of the job, right? It really tells you that we have been struggling to understand this. But the main thing to walk away from the book on this is, this was exactly the combination that Nixon and Kissinger were trying to avoid when they did the opening to China, right? And I was the author of the New York Times obituary for Henry Kissinger, which was nearly as long as the book, and spent a lot of time with him, and we talked a lot about what the objectives were during that time. And he already, you know, he lived long enough, because he lived to be 100 and just died last fall, to see this coming together. And he was pretty clear to me. He said, David, this is precisely what we were concerned about, you know, 50 years before. Mm-hmm.
You also talk in the book, you say that really none of the three superpowers, neither the U.S. nor China or Russia, have as much control either over global events or even over what's happening inside their own countries as they thought they would. Is that still the case?
I mean, I think it's more the case now than it's ever been. I mean, control over our own country, I mean, just start here. I forget the Russians and the Chinese, right? I mean, you know, we're in a situation here right now where the fundamental problem is that we're confronting is that there is a big section of the Republican Party and a somewhat smaller but noisy section of the Democratic Party where their view is, why are we dealing with any of this, right? You've got a Republican, Trump-inspired group that says, I don't want to be paying for Ukraine. Just put all that money in the border. Let's build up, as Trump has said many times, build up big walls around the country, and if anybody comes after us, we'll go deal with them. This is a tried and true strategy that has failed every single time we have tried it in history. But sure, why not one more time? And you've got a progressive side of the Democratic Party whose view is this is just an excuse for the military-industrial complex to go build up again. They would love nothing more than new Cold Wars. In fact, David, you've given them two now instead of one, and it will become an excuse for giant defense budgets when we need to be spending that money on health care, on K-6 education, and so forth. And they're right. I mean, that was where we were going to spend the peace dividend. It's just, it turned out it was a false peace, right? So that division certainly exists. There was, in the old Cold War, a predictability to it. We only had two players, right? We had a very limited number of decision makers. We knew where every one of their nuclear weapons was, and they knew where every one of ours was. We knew who had launch authority on their side. They knew who had launch authority on our side. That's why you could have that red hotline, right? Because probably whoever picked it up was the person you really needed to go talk to. Now you've got this combination of Russia and China and the introduction of Iran in what it calls the axis of resistance and other countries signing on, whether it is through buying Chinese telecommunications data or relying on the Belt and Road Initiative or whatever. And here we are trying to organize a coalition to keep Ukraine free. And while Biden talks about it as a great world movement, it's a great Western movement that involves, you know, the 32 members of NATO and a few other countries, Japan, South Korea, Australia. But there's a whole group of countries who say, as one chapter in this book is titled, Don't Make Me Choose. And the problem is when you come into a world where you have to decide who you're going to sell your advanced semiconductor equipment to because it's the core of everything they're going to build up militarily. As Gina Raimondo said in a story I wrote earlier this day, the Commerce Secretary, she said, when it comes to advanced technology, you can't be both in the China camp and the U.S. camp. You do have to choose.
Well, let's maybe drill down to Ukraine. So what's at stake for us in Ukraine?
So there are two ways to think about the Ukraine war. The first way is, here's a struggling, somewhat corrupt, highly imperfect democracy that we don't have a treaty obligation to go defend, but which Biden immediately turned around and stood up to go defend. And he did it with two instructions to his staff, which were somewhat in tension with each other. The first was, don't let the Russians win. Seems like a good, clear strategic objective. And the second was, don't start World War III, which meant U.S. troops were not going to get involved. The U.S. is not going to get involved in specific targeting. There's a section of the book where I talk about the Pit in Germany, which is a place where the Ukrainians, the Brits, the Americans all meet together to try to roughly figure out strategy and targets, but without specific targeting data, so that the lawyers can go back and say, we're following your instructions, Mr. President. Okay? So one way to think about Ukraine is, we're trying to defend its sovereign territory. The second way to think, and then you can have a debate in Congress. Do I want to defend a country that's not a NATO ally, where we've got no obligation, but we've spent $60 or $70 billion so far just in military aid, and do we want to keep doing that? That's a legitimate debate to have. People have different views on it. That's fine. The second way to look at it is, Ukraine is just the beginning. It's what Poland was in 1939. And that if you don't stop Putin there, a NATO country is next. And you will, by collapsing around Ukraine, invite him to go pick off another weak neighbor. And if Trump gets elected, probably Putin would go through a list of NATO countries that weren't paying 2% of the defense, right? And then, you know, what did Trump say? It was something along the lines of, I don't care what the hell you do with them
if they do whatever the hell you want.
Okay? That's also a strategic objective along the way. And so if you view that as what the Ukraine debate is all about, then you've got something a lot more apocalyptic for the West, right? Yeah. And the problem the Republicans in Congress are running into as they head toward this Saturday vote is many of them come from the party, the traditionalists, come from the party of anti-communism, now, you know, anti-Russia. But there's a second group that basically doesn't come from that grouping at all. And so the party is completely divided on a central tenet of American foreign policy. And if the Ukraine aid gets saved, it's going to be saved by some combination of Democrats who have become the Russia hawks, they never used to be, because of the 2016 election, and more traditional Republicans who grew up in the days when you were supposed to go contain communism as if Russia today was about communism. It isn't.
Let's sort of pivot to Asia, something we started trying to do in 2011 and still haven't been able to do. But what are our allies and partners in Asia? What lessons might they draw from Ukraine, and what lessons might China draw from war in Ukraine?
Well, let's start with the second part. If you're the Chinese, you're watching Ukraine like a hawk because you think, well, if the U.S. is going to, you know, go at this for 2 years but not actually commit troops, and then maybe pick up its marbles and go away, what do I think they'll do about Taiwan? A much harder military problem for us because it's 100 miles off of the Chinese coast and it's 3,000 miles off of our coast. And so what the U.S. response has been is to try to put together what in the Pentagon they call integrated deterrence. You can't get two people in the Pentagon to define it the same way. But essentially what it means is using all of the combined powers of your alliances to make life more difficult and stickier for the Chinese if they think they're going to go do this. And so we put money into building up the relationship between Japan, South Korea, and as of last week, the Philippines. You saw the Philippines leader here to meet with President Biden and the Japanese Prime Minister at the same time. You put money into experimental but likely to work undersea, basically submarine drones that can sit at the bottom of the Taiwan Strait and pop up and, you know, interfere with a naval movement across the strait. You help build up the Taiwanese so that they can hold off China. I spent a lot of time in Taiwan in the work on this book, and I spent most of it at Taiwan Semiconductor because they are the most interesting company in highest capitalized country in Asia right now, but also the place that makes 95% of the most sophisticated chips in the world. So including the microprocessor at the core of your iPhone. So if China decides to take Taiwan, my first piece of advice to you is do not drop your iPhone because you're going to be waiting a long time to go replace it. Taiwan Semiconductor is fascinating because while there, I was posing to their chairman and other members of their staff the question, is there a silicon shield over Taiwan, which is to say that China needs Taiwan Semiconductor as much as we do, and therefore they wouldn't attack it. And the conclusion I come to, don't want to ruin too much of the book for you because we want to encourage you to go buy it and read it, or as my book agent says, just buy it and then you can decide whether you want to read it, right? But the conclusion I come to is this is a diminishing shield, right? And the Chinese are having a hard time replicating the 3-nanometer circuits that the Taiwan Semiconductor has been able to do so brilliantly. But one day they're going to manage to do this despite our sanctions, despite our export controls. And when that day comes and they reliably can do it, their concern about wiping out Taiwan is going to diminish pretty fast.
So we have time for one more before we open it to the audience. And I can't let you, can't end without talking about Israel and Hamas and Gaza. There's a almost poignant sort of vignette near the end of the book where you talk about Jake Sullivan talking about how the Middle East, he spent less time on the Middle East than any of his predecessors in recent memory.
This was about a week and a half before the October terror attacks. And, you know, when he said it, it was true. He, you know, President Biden came into this to office determined to both extract us from over-involvement in the Middle East, but also to finally make that pivot to Asia work because our economic and military future depended on it, and you can't do everything. And then, of course, they were plunged back in it. From the beginning, they were worried about Bibi Netanyahu overreacting. It is not a national security secret here that Biden and Bibi Netanyahu do not get along, never really have, despite the public claims. One day, I won't live long enough, we will get the declassified transcripts of the conversations Biden and Bibi have had over, right? And if we're still expurgating words in the New York Times 50 years from now, you're going to read like every other word of these conversations because they are really going after each other. But it was interesting. When Biden was first going to Israel after the terror attack, he nearly didn't go because of emerging disagreements with Netanyahu on how to deal with Gaza. At one point, they just turned off all the food and water, and Biden and his aides are saying, you can't do this. This is a war crime, right? Biden shows up. They had opened up that spigot a little bit. At the end of his visit, after embracing Bibi and speaking to the Israeli people and saying we had their back and they'd been through the terrible shock of October 7th, there was one poignant line in his public speech. He said, I reminded the prime minister that after 9/11, we overreacted. And we did things that were inconsistent with American values that we have come to deeply regret ever since. Torture, invading a country that had nothing to do with the initial attack. You guys know the list as well as I do. And that came out of his fear of where Netanyahu was headed. No one could have known at that time that we would see 30,000 dead Gazans, some portion of which, I don't know how many thousand, were certainly complicit in the initial attacks. Maybe it's people in the hundreds, but many of whom were not. And you've seen the children and the women, and I don't need to run through the horror of this for you. And we've only turned away from that in recent days because of the Iranian counterattack last Saturday night. And we may, by the time we all leave here tonight, see the Israeli response. I think it's coming in the next couple of days, or could well be. And I think it'll be somewhat measured. But this has been, I think, the hardest problem for Biden to manage. It's certainly been the hardest one for Jake Sullivan and Tony Blinken, the Secretary of State. And they're in pain when you talk to them about this. I think they were in a place to condition the aid to Israel long before the president made his statements a week and a half ago. I think it was the president who was the most reluctant because he comes from a generation that was going to stand with Israel no matter what. And it took Chuck Schumer to sort of help pull him over to the view that you could be supportive of Israel and not necessarily supportive of Netanyahu and his government. And that's where he ended up.
So I have about 100 more questions, but I've had my time. So let's open it up to audience questions. If you have a question, raise your hand. We have microphones coming around, sir.
Yes, when you were speaking of NATO and Eastern Europe, James Baker, when the wall came down, told the Russians that we would not move any further east, and yet we expanded NATO on one side. And then on the other, NATO has made guarantees to places like Estonia, which is important and part of NATO, but strategically maybe not as important. How would you?
Great. Two excellent questions. So first thing to know is there is huge historical debate, which I've not had enough time to go dig into, about exactly what Baker said on this topic and whether he said we would not, or whether he was experimenting with the thought, what if we did not? You know, a very different kind of conversation. The best description of this is in my colleague Peter Baker's biography of Baker. They are not related in any way. He and his wife, Susan Glasser, wrote, came out a couple of years ago. And it's worth reading the pages on this topic. I think it's probably the best explication of what happened and what didn't happen. But there's a lot of myth that has grown up around it. Estonia and the smaller NATO countries, which you might include the two newest, Finland and Sweden. So NATO is an alliance. After the collapse of the Soviet Union, they said to neighboring countries, it's up to you. We're not going to force you to join an alliance you don't want to join. But if you do want to join, and you will meet the standards that NATO sets out in something called MAP, but it's basically an action plan to what you would need to accomplish, which obviously the Ukrainians have not yet satisfied, that it's up to you if you want to go join. And then it's up to, then the rules of membership are, before you can join, every member of NATO unanimously has to approve that you can become a member of the club. It's the most exclusive process other than buying a New York co-op that I can think of. Okay. So once you're in, there is no distinction in the treaty between a small, less strategic country and a large one. If they invade Lithuania or Estonia, NATO's credibility as an ally that will stand up under Article 5 is as great as if they invade Poland or Germany. And I'm not sure people were sort of thinking that through when they were letting Montenegro in, you know? I always think to myself, are you starting off in the wrong place if the President of the United States has to one day say, my fellow Americans, I am sending troops to fill in the blank of such and such a country that has just been invaded, and here's a big map to show you where that little country is, because otherwise you might not know. My wonderful Harvard colleague, Graham Allison, has this great phrase, which is, Americans learn geography by going to war. So that's that. And, you know, we had to think about that when we were letting them in. And at this point, they're members.
David, good to see you. My question is as follows. General Stan McChrystal is involved with a company called Rhombus Power. And he wrote a fascinating piece. And he said, in regards to using artificial intelligence to help predict what leaders are thinking and what they're going to do, I'm just wondering what role, if any, that you see artificial intelligence might play to avoid some of the decisions and guesses that we have had.
What kind of decisions?
The decisions that our various leaders have made in regards to putting us where we are today. In other words, they got these guesses wrong. And I wanted to know if you thought artificial intelligence might play a role in doing that better.
It may, but I have to stop and tell you my favorite Stan McChrystal story beforehand, which is that one day when I wrote a previous book in which Stan was a significant player in the book during his time in Afghanistan, he and I were speaking together on a stage like this at Texas A&M, and we were just delighted to see that even though there was a football game the next day, the entire hall was full of cadets from Texas A&M. And I was saying, God, Stan, this is amazing, people who showed up out here for us. And he said, don't be too impressed, David. He said, they're cadets. They were required to attend, okay? So I give my little talk at a podium, and we're on a stage that's a lot higher than this one. And I come off of it, and Stan walks around. It's dark in the auditorium, and he steps off the stage. And I thought to myself, oh, my God, this, like, great American hero is about to go be crippled, you know, in front of all of us. And he does a perfect paratrooper's role, gets up, dusts off his suit, and gives his talk. And every time I run into him, I always say the same thing, which is, I don't think a single soul at Texas A&M remembers anything we said that night, but they all remember the paratrooper role. So, to your question, artificial intelligence is going to have a huge impact in the way we make decisions, and there are things that we're going to have to wall it off from. The most interesting conversation underway on sort of a track two between the United States and China right now is whether or not to let AI play a role in, say, nuclear decision making or other use of weapons of mass destruction. That's a really hard question because the Pentagon's view of this is there's always got to be a person in the loop if there is going to be an action that could result in a death. And then their wording changed slightly. There has to be a human being on the loop. Does that make any difference? Yeah, makes a big difference. Because on the loop means you're allowing the algorithm to take over and you're just watching that it acts the way you think it was programmed to act. Mm-hmm. And the hard decision we're going to have to make in a number of national security arenas is whether or not you are going to let artificial intelligence push you to the decision, because the other side may well be using it. And if it speeds up offense, you may lose the battle while you are sitting around holding your meeting and the lawyers say, well, let's consider the implications of this. And meanwhile, the Russians and the Chinese are doing their thing. So it's not only a question of how we use it, but how they use it. Would it have helped in getting the probabilities right or wrong about how Russia and China would have reacted after the Cold War? And the answer is, it's only as good as its inputs. And if you are inputting something that has historically not happened before, you may get an interesting view of this, or you may get something that is as useful as your crazy uncle at Thanksgiving dinner espousing political views. Not that anybody here has ever had to go sit through that. And that's the big question. We don't know yet what it's going to be good at. We have some suspicions. I write a lot, as many of you know, about cyber, and my last book was The Perfect Weapon. I think AI will be extraordinarily good for cyber defense. It will also help offense, but it will be excellent for cyber defense because it will be able to detect patterns that we might miss of strange behavior of malware in a system. The Justice Department is already using AI-fueled technology to pick out from photographs potential offenders in the January 6th moments, right? Where it's great at comparing up facial recognition across thousands of pictures and tell you where somebody was walking all that time. But at the end of the day, you want the decision whether to prosecute to be made by a prosecutor. So the question is, do we let this be used as another tool, or do we let it take over the actual judgments? And that's a hard call. I mean, we thought essentially that autonomous driving would be safer on average, and it probably is, than having human beings at the wheel, right? AI systems don't go out and drink usually that night, that much on Friday night. But we also know that every time there's a fatal accident in a car that was on autopilot, it has a special resonance for us in a way that if you heard that somebody ran off the road without autopilot, you probably wouldn't pay attention. And so it's going to take a good number of years, maybe decades, to sort out what we want to use it for or not. And in life and death matters in government and private industry, that's going to be a harder and harder decision.
So unfortunately, I've been told we're out of time for questions, but David will be sticking around.
I will be sticking around to sign books for about half an hour before I have to disappear back to D.C., but thank you all for coming and for this discussion.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.